ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Friday, the 27th of February. I'm Rachel Mealy coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Today, first it was capital gains tax, now negative gearing. The government continues to drop hints of major reforms ahead of its May budget. And the childcare crackdown continues. Multiple centres on notice to lift standards, while a national Working with Children database remains years away.
If you're not prepared to meet the standards, then you shouldn't be receiving taxpayers' money. The events that happened in Victoria last year, I think, remind us why a national register is important.
Hillary Clinton has accused Republicans in the US of creating a distraction by questioning her instead of President Donald Trump over ties to the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The former First Lady and Secretary of State has come before the Congressional Oversight Committee investigating the US government's handling of allegations involving Jeffrey Epstein. The dramatic hearing, meant to be closed to the public, was derailed at one point when a photo of Mrs. Clinton was leaked to the press. Nick Grimm reports.
Thank you, everybody.
Emerging from her behind-closed-doors deposition, Hillary Clinton had more questions to face, this time from reporters as she departed the House Oversight Committee.
You can see everything. Thank you.
The former First Lady, US Secretary of State and one-time presidential candidate, revealing she'd faced repeated questions from the Republican-dominated committee.
I don't know how many times I had to say I did not know Jeffrey Epstein. I never went to his island. I never went to his homes. I never went to his offices. So it's on the record numerous times.
Hillary Clinton maintaining the line of questioning ranged from the repetitious to the ridiculous.
It then got, at the end, quite unusual because I started being asked about UFOs and a series of questions about Pizzagate, one of the most vile, bogus conspiracy theories that was propagated on the internet.
Pizzagate is a now widely debunked conspiracy theory that gained prominence during the 2016 presidential campaign, alleging high-ranking Democratic Party officials were involved in a child sex ring operating out of a Washington pizza restaurant. Ahead of Hillary Clinton's deposition, the Republican chairman of the House Oversight Committee, James Comer, said there were many questions the Clintons need to answer.
No one's accusing at this moment the Clintons of any wrongdoing. They're going to have due process. But we have a lot of questions. And the purpose of the whole investigation is to try to understand many things about Epstein. How did he accumulate so much wealth? How was he able to surround himself with some of the most powerful men in the world? Was he an asset for our government or any other government? These are the questions that we're going to ask over the next 2 days.
But some observers believe the Clintons' willingness to appear before the committee now establishes a crucial precedent that could come back to bite other political figures.
The case of the Clintons is interesting.
Stephen Fowler is a political reporter with American public broadcaster NPR.
Well, it certainly sets a precedent for future administrations and investigations that a president or a former president and their family have to appear before Congress or face contempt charges. I think that is part of the calculation of them agreeing to sit and do this at the same time.
While Donald Trump has repeatedly denied any wrongdoing in relation to the Epstein case, pressure is growing on the US president to himself face questioning, and in particular on claims the Department of Justice has withheld files containing allegations he sexually abused a girl in the 1980s. Media outlets have found references to the woman's claims among documents so far publicly released, alongside an interview she gave to investigators detailing her abuse as a minor by Jeffrey Epstein. Stephen Fowler was one of the first US journalists to report that three additional interviews concerning Mr. Trump are missing.
We know that there are documents related to an interview from a woman who made accusations of sexual abuse from 4 decades ago when she was a minor. We know that there is one interview that's been made public where that accusation is not mentioned. And we know that there are other documents that should be there based on the serial numbers that have been stamped onto these documents within the database.
Democrats say Donald Trump must be called to address the allegations. Robert Garcia is the senior Democrat sitting on the House Oversight Committee.
The person who actually appears more times in the files than the former president, who we want to speak with, is President Donald Trump. And so let's get President Trump in front of our committee to answer the questions that are being asked across this country from survivors and from those who have been brutally attacked and raped, sometimes as children.
Democrat Representative Robert Garcia ending that report by Nick Grimm. As the federal government continues to consider its policy decisions ahead of the May budget, speculation is mounting over whether it will implement changes to negative gearing and the capital gains tax discount. The opposition has said it's unlikely to support any changes, but housing experts argue multiple levers will need to be pulled to solve Australia's housing crisis. Tanya Dendrinos reports.
We're in the midst of both a housing and cost of living crisis. The government is already spending hundreds of millions of dollars to increase the amount of social and affordable homes, but more needs to be done. And fresh media reports suggest negative gearing could once again be up for reform. Health Minister Mark Butler didn't rule out the idea when asked on Sunrise whether the tax measure could be limited to two investment properties.
We've been very clear about our tax policies. We've been clear about our housing policies as well, trying to help young people, particularly into first home ownership. But we've also been clear that we think there is an issue around young Australians getting a fair break, breaking into the housing system.
Negative gearing makes rental losses tax deductible for investors, allowing people to offset their investment property costs against their income. Opposition leader Angus Taylor said he wouldn't support changes to negative gearing or capital gains tax.
It's extraordinary that a government that has completely failed to deliver on its housing targets, it's not even going to get close to its 1.2 million houses, now says that the answer to the problem in housing is to put a tax on it.
Yesterday, Treasurer Jim Chalmers said there are still many decisions ahead for the government before its May budget.
We haven't changed our policy, you know, on tax, which is to cut income taxes two more times. We do understand that there are intergenerational issues in the tax system and in housing. We're dealing with them in other ways, including the super change, the efforts to build more homes, the 5% deposits for people buying their first home. And as you know, we're considering other options.
Professor Alan Morris is an urban and housing studies scholar from the Institute for Public Policy and Governance at the University of Technology, Sydney.
The federal government needs to illustrate very, very concretely that they're doing everything in their power to dissipate the crisis. I mean, clearly, you know, you can't do it overnight, but I think the process has to start. I mean, to be fair, they have put a lot more money into social and affordable housing than the coalition government ever did.
As you mentioned, this isn't going to be something that is solved overnight, but what sort of levers do you think need to be pulled to get us moving in the right direction?
Look, I think the whole tax regime is clearly an issue. I mean, negative gearing and capital gains tax is making investment in housing very, very favourable. Positive. And I think it is contributing to higher house prices. You know, if you look at the revenue foregone, the predicted amount is staggering. So the Parliamentary Budget Office has predicted that between 2024-25, in the decade to 2033-34, $166 billion will be foregone in revenue because of negative gearing and capital gains tax.
He says limits to negative gearing would be a good start and would support phasing it out over time.
Besides increasing house prices, it's really benefiting the top 10 or 20% of the population. And what it's doing is it's cementing and accentuating inequality.
Professor Alan Morris from the Institute for Public Policy and Governance, ending that report by Tanya Dendrinos. 9 childcare centres that missed a federal government deadline to lift standards could soon lose funding. The crackdown is part of the government's response to allegations of child abuse and safety failures in some childcare centres. Today also marks the launch of a national worker register and mandatory child safety training. Angus Randall reports.
At a childcare centre in southern Sydney, Education Minister Jason Clare is working on his painting and drawing skills.
You can probably tell I'm the father of a four-year-old.
Today, the government is keen to show its childcare sector reforms remain a key priority and operators failing to meet quality standards are in its sights.
Of those 30, 19 of those centres have now met quality standards. Now, that tells me something. I hope it tells you something as well. And that is that the threat of having their funding cut off has forced them to act. Centres that haven't met the quality standards for 7 years have suddenly done it because they realise that we are serious here. This is not an idle threat.
As for the rest of the 30, one has closed, one is still waiting assessment, and 9 failed.
Now, some of those standards that centres may not meet might not be having safety signs, may be a dodgy step. It might be that the workforce don't meet the sort of ratios and requirements that we're talking about. They may not have an emergency response plan when a child is injured. They're the sorts of things, the sort of basic things that every centre should have.
Those who failed now risk losing access to government childcare subsidies, meaning parents who keep their children in these centres will likely see their fees dramatically increased. Those centres will be publicly named if they lose funding. Jason Clare has little sympathy for them.
If you're not prepared to meet the standards, then you shouldn't be receiving taxpayers' money.
Today also marks the launch of a national worker register to track staff movements and mandatory child safety training for all early educators. More than 100,000 educators have already registered for the training course. The worker register comes in the wake of horrific allegations against former childcare workers who were able to move between childcare centres with minimal oversight.
The events that happened in Victoria last year, I think, remind us why a national register is important. I ask you to think about the work that the Victorian Police had to do to try and find out where that individual worked.
Providers will have a month to enter their staff's details into the register and must update the register within 14 days when a staff member joins or leaves. Liddy Corner is the CEO of childcare recruitment agency Talent Now, connecting educators with childcare centres. She supports the national register after decades of separate state-based systems.
So this will mean that there's obviously a very clear picture of where people work and who's working. And it will also give the government a really nice picture of training qualifications, you know, who's studying where. And, you know, I think in the long term it will be very useful.
The National Child Safety Training has been developed by the Australian Centre for Child Protection and will focus on both child safety and child protection and reporting. Dr. Erin Harper is an early childhood expert at the University of Sydney.
The child protection training, absolutely, very much. That's going to be about identifying risk factors, identifying red flags, and knowing when and how to report potential concerns.
Staff will be required to complete the new training within the next 6 months.
Angus Randall. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on ABC Listen. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. The Victorian government will move to ban good character references for convicted criminals following years of lobbying by advocates for survivors of sexual assault. New South Wales took the same step earlier this year. It's a topic of discussion at the nation's Attorneys General meeting today. Dr. Jenny Gray is the Chief Executive of the Women's Legal Service of Western Australia. She joined me earlier. Dr. Gray, what have victim survivors told you about the impact of hearing good character references of their abusers being read out in court?
This is devastating for victim survivors of sexual violence. Victim survivors are invariably required to give evidence of their version of the harm that's been caused to them in a way that is adversarial. They're often interrogated by aggressive defence lawyers. the alleged perpetrator has the right to silence, and yet in sentencing, the offender then has the right to use good character references as a way of lessening the sentence. So in a way, that's minimising the victim survivor's account and also re-traumatising them, which leads to the scenario of why would you report in the first place if these are the kind of things that happen to you in the criminal justice system.
Defence lawyers have argued for some time that this is the only way they can let that person's character be seen rather than the crime in court. What's your view on that?
Defence lawyers often advocate for good character references because they see this as an opportunity to lessen the sentence for the person that they are representing. Good character references most benefit those who have privileged status and wealth in courts, because those are the people who have access to others who are likely to give them a good character reference. The good bloke reference, and it usually is blokes as well, it's often the bloke who has the privileged status and wealth who has also has access to vulnerable people in the first instance. We all know many stories where friends, colleagues and family members are absolutely gobsmacked when a perpetrator is convicted because they actually can't believe it, because that person is a good person, that person is a good bloke. And in fact, it's their goodness that they can often hide behind that allows the perpetration to continue.
Victoria has now joined New South Wales in banning these good character references. Queensland has taken steps to limit where they're used. Why do you see that this should be a national change?
We know that it advantages perpetrators and a particular group of perpetrators as well, and that it further disadvantages and re-traumatises victim survivors. It's essential that we have the use of good character references at sentencing abolished, and really importantly is that we have consistency around Australia so that all the jurisdictions have the same laws. So it doesn't matter for a victim survivor. It's not confusing if you're going from one state or territory to another. They have the assurance that good character references cannot be used as a way of minimising their story, their experience and their trauma.
What is the situation in Western Australia?
Western Australia hasn't introduced this change in legislation yet. We're really keen for the WA government to do it and follow the example set in New South Wales and Victoria.
How will you keep up that pressure?
We are talking to government at the moment. In fact, we had advocacy to government last week around this and other changes that put victim survivors in the centre and their needs foremost in the criminal justice system. We really need to be looking at the biases in the system that further disadvantage and create barriers for victim survivors to experience justice and even report sexual violence in the first place.
Jenny Gray, thanks very much for joining The World Today.
Thanks, Rachel.
And Dr. Gray is the Chief Executive of the Women's Legal Service of Western Australia. And if you're in an abusive situation or know someone who is, call 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. Denmark is off to the polls with a snap election called by Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen. The Prime Minister is riding a wave of popularity after her strong stance against the US President Donald Trump's attempts to take over Greenland. But critics say Prime Minister Frederiksen's international presence has come at the expense of domestic needs. Kimberly Price reports.
And we are so ready.
Campaigning is underway on the streets of Copenhagen after Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen announced Denmark is heading to the polls early. While there are domestic issues Danes want resolved, there's a looming figure hanging over the election.
The T-man across the sea.
US President Donald Trump's wish to take over Greenland has led to a surge in popularity for Mette Frederiksen. Standing up to President Trump, the Prime Minister declared the semi-autonomous Danish territory is not for sale, the decisive response resonating with these voters.
I think the government's done well in the Greenland thing. We have some leaders now who I have international experience, and so I think they've handled it well.
She's not my favourite, but she's put us on the map, so I think she will win.
Although not all Danes are happy with the incumbent coalition.
We have been this government by three parties, and that's a mess.
In announcing the poll, Mette Frederiksen argued Denmark's international reputation is at stake.
Det bliver også et afgørende valg.
This will be a crucial election for us because in the next 4 years, we as Danes and as Europeans will really have to stand on our own two feet. We must define our relationship with the US. We must arm ourselves to ensure peace on our continent.
In Denmark, it's not uncommon for multiple parties on the left or right to form a coalition government. But Mette Frederiksen's government is different. It includes more centrist parties. Dr. Benjamin LaRuth is a lecturer in public policy at the University of Melbourne.
We have a bit of a mix with the historically stronger social democrats joining a coalition with the liberals and the moderates. She's seen more as a centrist rather than the centre-left prime minister.
This formation has led to some left-wing voters feeling like their traditional policies have been forgotten. The social democrats saw a drop in support at recent local elections.
The Danish population still believes that this coalition is quite artificial and that led to some strong divisions when it comes to the government agenda, especially on issues such as welfare and social policy.
While domestic issues will play a role, Benjamin LaRuth believes international pressures will be a key factor for many Danish voters.
At the same time, the two other political parties that are in power at the moment, so the Liberals and the Moderates, will also try to play this card. I would argue that we'll see a surge in support for the three parties in power.
The Danes will head to the polls on the 24th of March.
Kimberly Price reporting. It may be the 11th hour in negotiations between Iran and the United States, but there are glimmers of hope that progress has been made in the ongoing nuclear dispute. Oliver Gordon reports.
The US wants Iran to drastically scale down its nuclear program and has gathered a fleet of aircraft and warships near the Middle East to pressure Tehran into a deal.
Over these long and very intensive hours, we made good progress and came close to a possible agreement, both in the nuclear field and in the area of sanctions.
Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi fronted Iranian state television following the conclusion of last-ditch talks in Switzerland to avert a military escalation.
On some issues, we have now come very close to an understanding. On certain other issues, we still have differences of opinion.
There was no immediate comment from the American negotiating team on the outcome of the talks. But US news sources have quoted a senior US official as saying the Geneva negotiations were positive. The talks mediator, Omani Foreign Minister Saeed Albusaidi, has also posted to X, describing significant progress and writing,
"We will resume soon after consultation in the respective capitals. Discussion on a technical level will take place next week in Vienna."
After striking Iran's nuclear sites last year, the Trump administration now wants a deal to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons. Iran has repeatedly denied it's seeking a bomb and says its program is only for peaceful purposes. It wants a series of sanctions imposed by the United States lifted. Back in the US, a new poll from the Associated Press reveals about half of adults in that country are either extremely or very concerned that Iran's nuclear program poses a direct threat to the United States. On Capitol Hill, Senate Democrats like Dick Durbin have weighed in.
I think the president's goal is our goal too, no nuclear weapons in Iran, and to try to throttle down some of the terrorist activity that's been sponsored by that country. With the notion of America going to war, the Constitution makes it clear the American people have the last word through members of Congress. If the president really wants to go to war, put troops in the field, he needs to come to Congress for authority.
Ali Vaez is an Iran expert at the International Crisis Group and says war could be days away if a resolution isn't reached.
So this is why it is important that the US is coming back to the table and trying to get to the finish line.
He says both sides need to negotiate.
The reality is that there is a narrow pathway to a deal, but it does require both sides to soften their red lines. It does require for President Trump to understand the kind of capitulation that he was hoping the extreme military, economic, diplomatic pressure on Iran would produce is just simply not on the cards. And if there is a solution in which the Iranians can save face, yes, there is an exit ramp available for both sides.
Negotiations are set to resume next week in Austria's capital, Vienna.
Oliver Gordon, and that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Bill and Hillary Clinton are being hauled before a US House committee investigating the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Today, David Smith from the United States Studies Centre at Sydney Uni on what we can expect from their depositions. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.